WATD presents Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
If it's Monday night, it's got to be Monday Night Talk with Kevin Tachi. So thanks for having me on.
Kevin, good for you to hold back and let him tell his story.
Putting the South Shore spin on politics, current events, and pop culture.
You guys are the center of the universe today, at least the political universe.
I believe both of you are from the area. Marshfield guys, yes, no?
Correct, yeah.
That's right.
There's only one person not from Marshfield in this room right now. That's you.
It's me. I'm the outcast.
Well, you've always been generous with the time. I appreciate it very much.
Well, I'm honored to be on your show tonight, Kevin, with that impressive lineup you have.
I believe our guest that we've been waiting for, Congressman Stephen Lynch.
Kevin, good to join you.
The governor of the Commonwealth, Charlie Baker. You ready?
I got to tell you that it's really nice to hear Aerosmith on the intro there.
You're going
to
be the rock and roll governor?
I don't know about that, but...
We have Mayor Joe Sullivan joining us, sir. How are you?
Well, Kevin, very good to be with you again.
Dr. Drew Pinsky. Dr. Drew, you there?
I'm here. Thanks for having me.
Mr. Ming Tsai, welcome to the show, sir.
Hey, thanks, Kevin.
Massachusetts State Auditor Suzanne Bump. Hello, Auditor. How are you?
I am fine, and I'm delighted to be with you this evening.
And now, your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome and good evening. You are indeed tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 ATD as we're coming to you live from Broadcast House, and it is 6:13, so it's on a Monday night, so it's definitely time for this radio program. We have a great show lined up for you. I say that every week, and hopefully I don't disappoint when it comes to 7:59 and you look back and you go, it was okay. So just to give you a rundown as to some of the folks who will be joining us. And again, I like the idea of having a variety of guests. It kind of gives you, you know, we could do a show on one topic and exhaust 2 hours, but would you really want to hear that? No, I think not. This week's guest, so happens that our first set of guests are in front of me. And no, this is not a repeat show, because joining us week number two, she's basically become my co-host. It is a State Representative Kathy Lenatra representing the 12th Plymouth District. I don't know how redistricting goes, so don't ask me to name off all 15 different communities that she serves. Kidding, of course.
15. I do serve quite a bit.
You
though.
Do. You do.
Yes.
She's here. Last week, if you remember, we spoke about one piece of legislation.
Yes.
Today we're going to have a conversation, and joining us for the conversation is Plimpton Fire Chief Stephen Silver. Chief, welcome to Monday Night Talk.
Thank you. Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
Great to have you here. And we're going to talk a little bit about VOTEX, vocational education, the importance of having vocational schools here in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. And I believe that leading the charge is Representative Lenatra, correct?
Correct. Actually, this came from a conversation that I had with Chief Silva. I meet with Chief Silva quite regularly, and we try to solve all the problems of the world. And our conversation last week was actually on VOTEX, and it was on the trades and the labor shortage.
Mm-hmm.
And Chief Silva, hopefully he will share the story that he told me about when he graduated from high school. And
a long time ago.
longer than me. Just a little bit longer than me.
Appreciate that.
Had a great story, and, you know, It kind of explains our labor shortage a bit, and I feel when he tells his story, you'll see that I think years past that we made it feel like you were less than if you didn't go to a 4-year school, or you were less than if you went to a vocational school, or you were less than if you went into the trades. And fast forward, really, it's not the case.
And what's interesting is that was a fantastic tease, because after traffic, Chief Silva will give us that story that he shared with the representative. That's what's going to be key. So I look for, in the business, it's called a tease. That was a fantastic tease.
That was fantastic.
You're already excelling as
a
co-host.
Look at that. Wait till week three.
Already excelling. I know, and Chief was ready. He was ready to launch it. So it was long. He was ready. He was there. But we're gonna press the pause button as we run down the rest. Waiting in one of the wings out here in WATD's broadcast house, Joe Rossi, Joe Flood, as we know him, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition. I'm going to check in with Joe to find out the latest when it comes to flood insurance. There's this big piece of federal legislation that was signed. I would be curious if there's something bundled in there, or was it just left on the cutting room floor somewhere? We'll talk to Joe about that and see what's, is this any pending legislation, whether it's in this bill that's been signed into law up in New Hampshire, or if there's something pending down the road. So that's hour number one. We've already teased you with some of the contents. Hour number two, everybody's favorite automotive expert, Junior D'Amato, will be joining us. And Junior, we're going to talk with Junior about the used car shortage. Did you know that there's a bit of a shortage when it comes to buying used cars? Shortage to the point where it's a bit more costlier to buy a used car than to buy brand new. We'll talk with him about that and some of the vehicles that he has been test driving as of late. Final guest of the show, and you definitely want to tune in. Michelle LaRue. Michelle is a Boston Marathon bombing survivor, and she is also here to talk to us about trials and tribulations as she's recovering and going through many surgeries. How she had to go through so many trials when it came to pain medications and medications for PTSD, and then finally finding something that worked in marijuana and cannabis, as she is a spokesperson for Curaleaf's iCannabis campaign. We'll talk to her about that. So that's coming up in just a few minutes, but that's technically hour number two. So what we'll do right now is we are going to find out what's happening one final time out on the roadways, being brought to you on this end by Brennan Smoke Shop, online at brennansmokeshop.com. There are several locations: Brockton, Plymouth, Pembroke, Wareham, Raynham, Taunton, Stoughton, New Bedford, Weymouth, and now in Hudson, New Hampshire. And awaiting us with a final report is Lisa DeMilo. Lisa, how are things out there?
Well, you know, Kevin, still inching along on the expressway southbound from the tunnel to Columbia Road. You get a little bit of running room, but then you're on the brakes from Furnace Brook to the split. Northbound slow from East Milton Square to Freeport Street. Route 3 South delays from the expressway to Union Street. 93 South still crowded from Route 37 to Route 24. Northbound's busy from Route 138 to Route 24. And Route 24 South, that's congested from 93 towards Route 139. This report is sponsored by UPSJobs.com. UPS is now hiring warehouse workers, personal vehicle drivers, driver's helpers, and more. Visit UPSJobs.com/shift to apply. Make the shift, make a difference. Traffic on the nines every morning. I'm Lisa DeMilo in the WATD Traffic Center.
Hey, it's Jeff from Brennan Smoke Shop. I know a lot of companies out there are having a hard time filling their positions. Well, we're not one of them. We don't have any positions because our squad is full. My people came right back to work after quarantine, and they've been here ever since. Vax, no vax, my people don't care. They love what they do, they love doing it for you, and I love them for it. Brennan's Smoke Shop is a small, family-owned and operated chain. My employees are my family. We're the Brennan's Smoke Shop family. This year, a special super-duper happy Thanksgiving to Chris, Mike P., Justin, Hannah, David, Brady, Jen, Linda, Amy, Carrie, Thomas, Oren, Rachel, Kiara, Katrina, Mike M., Jane, Jess, Jackie, John Paul, Jason, Heidi, Johnny, Jeffrey, my wife Mal, Mom and Leo, and last but not least, a new addition to the squad, Joshua in Rainham. Brennan's Smoke Shop, the best smoke shop in Massachusetts and New Hampshire. Customers must be 21 years of age or older. Proper ID is required.
Download previous episodes of Monday Night Talk and listen to them anywhere. Check out 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And now, more Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back to Monday Night Talks. I'm Kathy Lenatra, your co-host this evening. And as I said in our last tease, I'm going to introduce Chief Silver. He is the chief of the fire department in Plimpton. And he had shared a story with me, and he's going to share it with you.
Thank you, Kathy. So we were talking last week, Kathy and I talk often about all the problems of the world, which we seem to solve on a regular basis, at least in our minds. And we were talking about trades and vocation and maybe the lack of trade schools or at least the labor shortage we have. And it brought me back down memory lane on myself to how did I get to where I am? And it's kind of an interesting story that still is current, even though it happened over 40 years ago. So back in the 70s, yeah, it was the 70s, you know, what I remember of
it. I was three.
You were three? Yep. Yeah, I was a little more than three. And, of course, when you get to like a junior or senior in high school, you have to visit with your guidance counselors over in Brockton, and they tell you what you're going to do for the rest of your life. And I remember sitting down with my guidance counselor, a wonderful woman, and I said, yeah, I think I really want to be a paramedic and a firefighter. And she just looked at me and said, no, that's not going to happen. I go, well, why not? And she goes, well, you're too smart for that. You can't do that. You know, that's not what you're going to do. I'm like, but that's what I want to do. No, that's not how it's going to work. You have a flair for writing, and you're going to become a broadcaster, ironically. And here I am, right? So next thing I know, I'm at Syracuse, going to college and hating every minute of it, bored out of my mind. Got involved with a student-run ambulance, and everything kind of derailed on the broadcasting side of life. And all these years later, wound up becoming a fire chief. And what it brought up to me was that it's funny how we tend to judge vocation as almost a second choice in right. life. And that's wrong. It's very wrong. You know, I also teach over at Massasoit in Middleborough, and I know this to be true. And I looked up the stats today, and I think it was Forbes magazine published that one out of every five students in a community college actually has a bachelor's degree in something else.
Mm.
Because what we've done, I think, and maybe part of it's my generation's fault, maybe it's my parents' generation, we put so much value on going to college. It's not to say there's nothing wrong with going to college, but what I'm trying to get at is that you had to. In other words, you came out of high school and you were expected to go to college. And then we created a whole generation of kids that are going on to essentially grades 13, 14, 15, and 16.
Mm-hmm.
And coming out with a bachelor's in maybe an unemployable skill, maybe not what they really wanted, because there's almost a class warfare. Oh, you went to vocational school. Oh, really? As opposed to, yeah, I did that, and now I'm a computer technician, I'm a nurse, I'm a firefighter. And we get these kids that are coming out with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt, unable to pay it, it's unsustainable, and yet I have a lot of my son's friends and my daughter's friends that went more of a trade route. They're firefighters, they're nurses, and have done well in life, very well.
I think, you know, I've talked to a few college graduates that do have hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. Some of them are in the medical field, nurse practitioners, and they're doing really well. But still, with their salary to pay this, mm-hmm. it's hard for them to get a house, right? It's hard for them to move on and get a home. I have a son that has some college debt. I have another son who didn't have a lot of college debt and went into after his bachelor's degree, went into the service. So he'll go back to school on the GI Bill, which is great. But there's an opportunity here for our younger people to get an education for a career in a vocational school. They go to school to come out in a career,
mm-hmm.
which hasn't been the case in our four-year schools. I see that some of our community colleges are starting to do them now. Like you've said, like you have your bachelor's degrees coming back for their second,
mm-hmm.
Second degree for an associate's degree, but there's so many certificate programs now that are fantastic
exactly.
that help them in their career. But the vocational schools, which I find, and I've talked to my friend John Creed about this too, is it sets them up for a career without that college debt.
Well, see, we missed something. One of the things I think we missed, when I was growing up, you had blue collar and white collar,
mm-hmm.
and there was always a separation between
right.
it, you know. My dad was a worker at the Quincy Shipyard. My entire family worked at the shipyard except for me at one time or another. And that was a strong blue-collar, you know, union label, let's get going type thing, which is great. And then the white-collar, of course, was the more executive type, the banker, the lawyer, things like that. And nothing wrong with it, but we wound up having two separate classes of people without even trying to do that. It just became that way.
Right.
And now, our blue-collar jobs, I heard the phrase coined, are now gray-collar jobs.
Ah.
Meaning it's a blend.
Right,
so,
right.
And that's easily taken care of to figure this one out pretty simple.
Mm-hmm.
Open the hood of your car.
Mm-hmm.
Just open the hood of your car and look at that engine.
Sure.
You know, I used to, you know, break an engine down in your driveway. You know, you're taking your old 69 Chevelle and you can tear it apart. Now, you actually need a degree in computer science, I think, to work on some of these cars. Mm-hmm. Look at the fire service. I work with people that have master's degrees. I know chiefs that are working on their PhDs. We are blue collar, but we're more gray collar now, I think, at this time, because life has changed. It's become more technical. There are more skills that are in demand. In my job in particular, between the paramedicine, what we've gone through with COVID, mm-hmm. and the emergency management side, hazardous materials, I know people that are chemists and are on the fire department, and we don't do a good job, I think, of explaining to kids in high school today, and some kids in college that are lost and they don't know what they want to do, of saying it's good to be gray collar. It's good. If you're good with your hands, you're smart, you can think on your feet. Not everyone needs to be an attorney. Not everyone needs to be a physician, although we're short on both.
Right.
But
not short on attorneys.
Well, that's true. They're all at the state house.
I work at the state house.
You got a point. But we're missing that. We're missing that.
And if you're just tuning in, we're having a great conversation talking about vocational schools, the importance of vocational schools in the void that we're seeing in the workforce today, because more and more, not that there's anything wrong with going to a four-year school. Now it's being pushed where, you know, if you're a teacher, you could get a 4-year degree, right, and be all set. Now the educational system is expecting you to go to get a master's degree or go beyond that. I have been fortunate to, over the past many years, it's funny you mentioned John Creed.
Yes.
John Creed is kind of the common thread here because back as a cub reporter many, many years ago, as kind of a little side job, would write for the Enterprise and the Patriot Ledger.
Mm-hmm.
John Creed was the guy who would be my media interpreter, going, "Oh, this isn't good right here. You want to pay attention to this." He would steer me, or yes, try to steer me as to what he thought would be the good story to write up, unless we did something like For the Record, and then normally would just kind of do mm-hmm. a breakdown as to all the things that were encompassed in that particular meeting. But John also, so I saw John at Southeastern Regional, which is over in Easton.
Yes.
And also in Hanover for the South Shore Votech. And he was there as well as a media liaison. And seeing and hearing, right now it's Superintendent Director Dr. Tom Hickey, who he and the school committee, and I can't tell you how many meetings I've sat through to hear them proudly talk about their students going out and being able to work on jobs and get that, you know, that valuable experience, students graduating and being able to go into the workforce, right, because they spent 4 years in carpentry. They spent mm-hmm. so many years in the automotive shop that they were able to do these things, that they earned valuable skills while they were housed there, you know, at South Shore Tech, now it's called South Shore Technical High School.
They are valuable skills. And that, you know, you have yours. The way that I remember it, at South Shore Votech, I didn't go there, but my brother went there. It was like a week of regular classes and then the week of what you were in, say it was mm-hmm. automotive or carpentry.
Yes.
But I recently met a new hairdresser, I'm going to say, so hairstylist, and she's a little younger than I am, and she just became a hairstylist, and she always, that was her dream, always wanted to do it, but was told that, no, you're too good for this, and didn't. And here she is living her dream, and I've never seen her happier. So I think it is important to listen to our children, and I was guilty of it with my oldest. I'm not going to lie. I was guilty of it as well. Really listen to what they want to do. But the vocational schools, they teach them the skills for the job, but it also teaches them how to be an employee. And it teaches them how to be a leader, which we talked about before, Chief Silva.
Exactly.
You know, we're not teaching our children really to be leaders anymore either. Not all. I don't want to make this a blanket that it's for everybody, but mm-hmm. I thought it was an important thing to bring up today, to talk about vocational schools and the trades and how important they really are, and about the labor shortage and why we have that labor shortage. And this maybe is one of the reasons, but they're great jobs with great benefits and great skill set.
The labor shortage is across the board.
Mm.
When I started off in my career in the fire service, it was very difficult to get this job. You took the civil service exam, you were on the waiting list, you hoped and prayed for the best. Now, we can't find people. You know, people with experience in paramedicine, people that want to be a firefighter, I have friends that are police chiefs, they have the same problem on
mm-hmm,
their side.
They do.
I think we're not explaining, maybe, our jobs in a good way to the younger folks. when people think, in my case, of the fire department, what do they think of? You know, the big shiny red truck, and we're running around, and we're crazy people, right? They watch way too
much. Dodge spots.
Exactly. Chicago Fire, it's the drama, the soap opera.
He's right.
It's true, and they don't have a handle on what we're doing, but they'll go out and they'll see, I don't know, Wolf of Wall Street or something like that, and how they can make $1 million in 5 minutes. And
it's funny, I was watching that last night.
Oh, right. There you go, right? You can see me, I'm punching my chest here.
Absolutely.
But the point is, we don't do a good job of showing that the gray collar, I'm not going to call it blue collar anymore.
Right, I like that.
Are professions. They are professions. They're
proud,
not just...
Proud professions.
A proud profession. And a profession that's changed, has evolved, from the fire department to HVAC guys, who are essentially engineers now, mm-hmm. when they're designing the systems. Carpenters, have you tried to build a house lately and see what goes into it? It's not just some guy or gal getting up and going to work with a lunchbox, you know, in the old days with the overalls on. That's not what blue collar is.
No, there's codes you have to follow. Every state has its set of codes that you must follow and guidelines
exactly.
you go by.
Yeah. We are professionals. You know, it's. I can remember when I was real young, like junior high school, right? They defined what a profession was. So lawyers were professionals, doctors were professionals, certain CEO level was a professional. Early 70s, broadcasters suddenly became a profession. It was actually, there was a book that said these people are professionals. You know, we actually were cubbyholing people. We need to get away from that, because I think it's still there today in a lot of ways. And it's there with parents, with their children, saying you must go to college. Well, that's great. There's nothing wrong with college as long as there's a plan with it.
Right, as long as there's a plan. The worst thing we can do for our kids is they go to college for a four-year degree, and yes, they get this extra learning that makes them so well-rounded, but mm-hmm. they're coming out with hundreds of thousands of dollars worth of debt. It really isn't, the return on investment isn't there like it used to be there.
Right, if you become an electrician, let's say you become an apprentice, mm-hmm. right? You're coming out of school, you learned about electrical work,
yes.
yep. Innovotech, mm-hmm. and then you go on, you sign on with someone to be a journeyman. I mean, think of the money you can make as someone who's an electrician.
The demand is never going to end. If anything, it's going to become more.
Right. Mm-hmm. And you know, you sign on to be a journeyman, and how much debt are you incurring? You're not.
Right.
Right. My daughter's a nurse, and she's an ER nurse, and my son is a firefighter. And they both see this from there. And there's no question there's a nursing shortage out there. That's whole nother crisis we can get into.
We can talk about that in week
forever.
5.
But I think what we lost is, and Mike Rowe put it this way, he said, skilled labor is not a fallback position. It's a positive career choice. And we're not letting people know that. We can get in the whole conspiracy thing about student loans and how we're indenturing people, essentially, when they're coming out of college. They're never going to get ahead. I don't have an answer for any of this. I wouldn't pretend if I did. But I do know we're not marketing, or maybe the better word is counseling, young people on what their options might be, other than, okay, I graduated, now I must go do this. No, you don't must go do anything. You need to have somebody mentor you, help you develop a plan. What do you like to do? And if what you like to do makes sense, and work with people back and forth. And as far as the Votech schools and the community colleges, and I know Kathy is a champion of this, I think they need to catch up with this as well. Because vocational training, especially in the community colleges, doesn't always fit the semester approach, if you will.
Right,
It just keeps going.
Sure,
so long.
But community colleges also offer workforce development certificates.
Correct.
They do,
which go a long way.
So a lot of the four-year schools are also starting to do that. Bridgewater State is starting to change their whole look, too, and they're starting to educate their students for a career. Mm-hmm. So when they go out, they have a career. I'm part of the Future of Work Commission, which is a great commission that I'm so grateful that I was appointed to. And we go across the Commonwealth and we speak to presidents of colleges, and I think that professional colleges, well, junior colleges, mm-hmm. the two-year schools are going, you're going to start to see that they're going to take a bigger role.
Mm.
You
they
know?
Have to.
They have to with the certificate
a void here
programs,
that has to be filled.
Too. Yeah.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the Plimpton Fire Chief, Stephen Silva, and 12th Plymouth District State Rep, Kathy Lenatra, a.k.a. the co-host. and we're talking about the importance of, I think this is kind of, we started out with a talk about the importance of vocational schools, mm-hmm. but I think also two-year collegiate institutions like junior colleges, community colleges, their importance. Is there anything being done on the state legislature side of things? Is there any talk about investing monies, whether it's ARPA monies or long-term future monies, into VOTECs and community colleges?
Yes, there is. There's a lot of talk about that. And what this being on this work commission is, when the end of the report, I think will be very helpful for everyone looking into the community schools and what they're offering to their communities and with their certificate programs. And like I said, Bridgewater State's starting to get on board too. And just actually what the future of work looks like. What are the new employment avenues that people can go into, the new vocations that people will have, because there will be different things. Things are different. Everything evolves. So this is a great commission for us to be on. We were in Western Mass last month. We were in Plymouth a couple months ago. That was fantastic. Former Senate President Terry Murray spoke, and that was great. And Fred Clark from Bridgewater State. So there'll be a lot more to talk about at the end of this commission.
So the idea is hopefully this is something that will turn into a funding mechanism to better fund vocational schools? Is that what I'm anticipating?
That's what we're anticipating, vocational schools. But also, you know, our regular high schools, all school needs to have more funding. So I don't want to just say just vocational schools.
Okay.
We need, you know,
and
school
funding. And that's a good
funding point,
because there are not that many vocational schools by comparison. You know what we need to get back to is the old-fashioned job fair. You used to see that somewhere on your junior or senior year, that companies or whomever would come in, different municipal services and such, and just to inform people, young people, what their options might be, because there's so many kids I see coming out of high school that will eventually come by my station and we'll bring them on as a call firefighter or a call paramedic or EMT. They were just lost. They didn't know this was an option. And we're not getting that word out. And it's not just the fire service. We're not getting that word out for the police. We're not getting that word out for the carpenters. We're not getting that word out for the electricians. And just name any one of the former blue collar, the now gray collar. We need to get the word
out. That's a great point, Steve, because we do have college fairs all the time, right? And the military will be there. That's the other option.
Right?
So it would be a college fair with the military there, but not a job fair.
Not the trades.
That's fabulous.
But isn't this something that maybe the trades can also be a partner in? I mean, if there is a shortage in many of those, you know, those areas, to get involved, a partnership between, you know, the state government and some of those trades and some of the unions.
Right.
To help recruit and say, hey.
And they have been, Kevin. I've seen them around. I've spoken to many union leaders, and they are reaching down to the vocational schools or even the high schools. And there's this great organization, it's Work Skill, and they reach down to two young women that I met that really had nowhere to go. One was on the streets, and she got into this program, and now she's going to be in the union and changed her entire life. So they are reaching down to the younger group. And we had talked about, there's another chief that I'm friendly with in Marshfield too, and he's reaching down to the high schools too for EMTs and that type of thing. You can get your EMT when you're in high school, right, Steve?
You can. You can, as long as you you're 18 to take
right.
the test.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, you can start
you can
EMT
start.
In high school. The town of Middleborough, where I came from before I went over to Plimpton, they actually run a program for seniors where they spend 1 or 2 days a week, a regular class amount of hours, an hour or so, 1 or 2 days a week, at the fire station. And they learn all the skills of firefighting up to a level of what's known as Firefighter 1, which is kind of the entry level into our profession. And I know for a fact, having talked to Chief Benjamino and having actually been there and seen these classes, that recruitment that comes out of those kids, they're working everywhere. They found their passion in the fire service. And these types of programs are things we need to get behind. We need to catch these kids when they're young. And they're formidable, and they're formulating their plans for life. But if no one's there to help them with their plans, to
and
guide
to give
them.
Options, I think.
Options,
you
exactly.
You know, options is such a great thing. And not that you need to know what you're going to do.
No,
right?
but again, particular models. I keep leaning on the South Shore Technical High School, where they've, you know, they're not just basically just staying with woodworking or
right.
electrical. I mean, they do horticulture now.
And health sciences.
They got the Brass Lantern, where there's culinary. And they got,
there's
you're talking
so
about getting a haircut.
Yes.
Right. You know, they got cosmetology. I mean, so, you know, there's so many that are branching out, and if there's enough funding for.
But we got to give value to that.
We definitely do.
Because
right.
people, it seems, the middle class working people in this country, I think we've been devalued. That's a whole other show with a whole bunch of reasons. But
I would welcome it.
We have been devalued, and I think we got to break that. And it's become a vicious circle. It's become almost a financial game. Again, Roe, who I love, Mike Roe, you know, lending money that we don't have to kids that will be forever in debt, that cannot pay it back, looking for jobs they're not even trained for. That paradigm has to stop.
Mike Rowe of the Dirty Jobs, Mike Rowe.
Yes.
Mike Rowe, Dirty Jobs. Brilliant man.
Brilliant man.
That's all the time we've been allotted for this particular site. I know we could keep talking, and I want to say hello to Dr. Tom Hickey who just messaged me. Let me know that he was tuned in, was unable to join us. I did try to ask him to join us, but I mean he's a busy man, and all that he does and that school does, it's understandable. Anything quickly that you want to say in closing, Representative?
I would just like to thank you again, Kevin, for letting me come on 2 weeks in a row with these ideas. But I think it's important. I think that bill that we spoke about, I know that bill that we spoke about last week was extremely important to many. And I think this is very valuable information. And I can keep bringing you things because Chief Silver and I keep talking and keep trying to solve the problems of the world. But thank you for having us on.
Chief Silver, I thank you for coming in. And I welcome you back in, knowing that you have a broadcasting background. Maybe we could have a little trio going on here.
There we go.
Okay.
How about that?
All right.
Sounds great.
Again, you've been tuned into a special segment of Monday Night Talk talking about vocational schools, their importance, community colleges, with Kathy Lenatra, your representative in the 12th Plymouth District, as well as Chief Stephen Silva from Plimpton, the fire chief. Thank you both for coming in.
Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you very much, Kevin.
We're going to step aside, and when we come back, more Monday Night Talk. Don't go anywhere.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
McGuigan's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McGuigan's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McGuigan's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McGuigan'sPub.com.
What is AA?
Alcoholics Anonymous is an international fellowship of people who have had a drinking problem.
It is non-professional and self-supporting.
AA is multiracial, apolitical, and available almost everywhere.
There are no age or education requirements. Membership is open to anyone who wants to do something about their drinking problem.
For more information, literature, and videos about Alcoholics Anonymous, and to find a meeting near you, visit AA.org. Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
All right, we're back. Sorry, there's a little back and forth. Sometimes it's so hard to say goodbye to your guests and be like, bye, you know, because you won't even have the crossover conversation, but we shift gears fast and furious here. You are tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD. If you miss any of our past episodes, it's up to date. You can go on, download. If you're somebody who loves podcasts, I promise you, if you like the local things that we talk about, you will not be disappointed. It'll be worth listening to on your train ride in. Monday Night Talk. Actually, just go to the WATD homepage. Look for podcasts and click on Monday Night Talk and download the latest episode. It's that easy. Well, joining us is a good friend, a reoccurring co-host. he's actually here for two segments, so he technically will be in the co-host role. It's Mr. Joe Rossi, Joe Flood, executive director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition. And this guy, he is a lock when it comes to talking about flood insurance, knowing what's going on with the rates. Joe, how are you?
I'm good, Kevin. How are you?
Good. And just to tease second hour, Joe's going to be sticking around because he and Junior D'Amato kind of, when we're talking cars, actually Joe's in the market for a new set of wheels, and he's like, hey, I wouldn't mind sitting in and talking with Junior and picking his brain as to the used car market. And so Joe will be staying on for an additional segment. So we thank you. So Joe, I teased it in the opening when I normally give an idea. I spill out my guts as to what we will talk about on the radio program. And one of the things that I teased was, is it possible that the Biden administration might have had some wisdom about themselves when they were seeking out votes to put together this fantastic, $1.2 trillion bill?
Yeah.
Is there a possibility that flood insurance, you know, the National Flood Insurance Program would have some kind of say in that, all that money?
Yeah, well, you know, as the audience knows, and as you know, Kevin, from listening to me over the years, the NFIP, or the National Flood Insurance Program, we talk about it so much because it really has three key parts, right? It's the insurance aspect, but it's also the mapping, and it's also the mitigation or local floodplain ordinances, as we call it, floodplain management. And so this bill touches everything but the insurance aspect. So it's actually pretty interesting. The insurance piece, which is just ongoing through people being able to purchase flood insurance, actually wasn't so much impacted by this bill, but could be by the reconciliation bill. So the insurance piece is going to come later. But what was passed in the infrastructure bill is actually quite astounding when you look at the dollar signs in front of some of these pieces. So, for example, the infrastructure bill puts about $3.5 billion into FEMA's flood mitigation assistance program. So that's grants that go to communities to assist in the acquisition, elevation of repetitive loss structures, the mitigation of buildings that are also not repetitive loss. So there's a lot of money going there, the largest single allocation of funds. $1 billion is going into the BRIC program. That's the large infrastructure type of grant program. There's over $1 billion for dam safety and dam removal. There's about $500 million going into a program that was started earlier this year, was started with almost no funding, which is a revolving loan program for states to use to do infrastructure projects, so that it's a loan. So that will hopefully be easier to tap into than grants. So there'll be a grant program, but now there's also a loan program. And then there's additional funds to other things like mapping, flood mapping, and stuff like that. But what this bill really shows is that there's been a big emphasis put on to the infrastructure of preventing floods versus the response to floods. And I think that is the first time probably ever that this country has prioritized preventing versus responding.
But do you feel that this is a comprehensive plan moving forward, that it isn't just a Band-Aid, especially when we talk about rising seas and knowing that, you know, the more we talk about global warming, this is something we have to keep in mind when it comes to our coasts?
Yeah. Well, the concern I have is not so much is this a Band-Aid, because it's the largest allocation of funds ever for any of these programs. Okay. The concern I have is the community's ability to access those funds. It is constantly a concern for communities which are sub-applicants to FEMA for their grant programs to be able to easily access federal funding. There's usually about three layers in between the individual and the community getting those funds.
Okay.
And it takes a lot of bandwidth from the community. So, yes, there are definitely concerns that still exist, especially when access. So the money can certainly be there, but it's about getting the money to where it needs to go, which is really the next logistical step to implementing this funding, this bill. But then I'll tell you that the National Flood Insurance Program, through all of its transformation recently in Risk Rating 2.0, and in the prior iteration of the National Flood Insurance Program, still does not have an affordability program. So the NFIP is, you know, they set rates based on risk, and it's now more accurate than ever with Risk Rating 2.0, but that doesn't count. There's no affordability piece. And in the reconciliation
reconciliation bill, which is the bill that should follow this one, there's about $1 billion allocated to pay for flood insurance for those that can't afford it. So that would be the last piece of the three parts of the NFIP that are addressed in these bills.
When you talk about as far as the delivery method of that funding, is there... Do you feel that that infrastructure is being built as we speak to be able to deliver those funds? And are there going to be terms like shovel ready, or this has to be something where planned, something has to be, it can't be just something that materializes within the next 30 days. It's something that has to already be in works and can be executed.
Well, the one thing FEMA's been really good at over the last, 20 years is asking communities to develop what they call hazard mitigation planning.
Okay.
And this funding, the HMA or the Hazard Mitigation Assistance Grant Program, target shovel-ready projects that communities have in their hazard mitigation plans. So you get a hazard mitigation grant for something that's in the community's hazard mitigation plan. So I would say most communities in Massachusetts do have a hazard mitigation plan. Whether those projects are, shovel-ready or not, the more shovel-ready they are, the better, obviously. But if they are in the plan, they will get funds, or they're able to get funds by applying. The real issue that has been around for a long time is the disconnect between the community's bandwidth to apply for these grants and the federal government's ability to help the communities apply. Now, there has been funding made available more recently to expand that bandwidth, but it's still a concern for most communities. Communities get turned off when you hear that you've got to go through a year-long process to get applications together, get people interested, go through the outreach and organization process. And at that point, a lot of communities say, okay, I'm all set. I'm done with that. And we do have resources at the Mass Costa Coalition to help communities move through that process. Actually, we've been working on a program called HELP for the last couple of years that actually helps communities, therefore its name, helps communities go through that process to get bandwidth in order to apply for grants. So it's something we've recognized for a while.
What is it like, you and your team, to when you get new information, fresh information like this, and try to disseminate what it is and how it's going to be usable for folks long term? Again, this is great news, but someone has to understand this, comprehend it, and then translate it to the folks who might not understand it as clearly.
Yeah, it's that's been a struggle for us this fall. I'll tell you that I have never seen so much information come out at one time across all parts of the National Flood Insurance Program. We have the insurance changes through Risk Rating 2.0, tons of requests for information from FEMA. We have the grant, the bills that have been passed here for funding opportunities. We're stretched so thin in all aspects right now, trying to dive into this information. That we've released kind of combined information. We're advocating on some things behind the scenes. We've really tried to focus our energy in places that require that immediate attention. For example, Risk Rating 2.0 had some immediate issues we had to advocate for and are working through those still. A bill like this, we probably won't even address until next year because it will take time for FEMA to develop rulemaking around it. That could take 6 months or so. So there's still some lag between when this comes out and when we start to really dive into it. But we've been really busy this fall, Kevin, since August, through my insurance brokerage at Joe Flood Insurance, or whether it be through the Mass Costa Coalition, the MCC. All the different things that I'm involved in all relate to each other because of all the different flood-related issues out there. And starting in August, things really heated up, and there's a lot going on in the space right now.
And how are things going for you insurance-wise, knowing that you're kind of a startup? How's
sure,
that going?
We're doing really well. I will say we are a wholesale operation, so we are not retail. So for those out there listening, if you are an insurance agency, then we help. And that's who we sell insurance, flood insurance for. And in that, we're actually building out some technology to allow people to be able to go online and get quotes automatically right through us and do some rate comparisons and stuff. So we've got some exciting stuff going on there. But what's really interesting is Risk Rating 2.0 and seeing through the agents that we help, really it's right now all across the country, the agents that we work with, seeing the variations and the rates coming in. I've been asked by a lot of people, what are some of the similarities in things you're seeing, some of the patterns you're seeing and some of the rates for, through risk rating 2.0? And my response is there are very few. And that's because FEMA has developed a program that targets the individual characteristics of a home, which I think is, in a way, some may be hesitant to think that that could be beneficial, but I believe it's been really helpful in explaining to somebody why their particular risk is higher or lower than it may have been perceived in the past. So, that opportunity in having the wholesale brokerage has really given me a much better perspective about what's going on around the country in terms of insurance rating.
When you look back, I remember the first conversations you and I had about flood insurance and protecting yourself and floodplains and maps and FEMA maps. How often do you look back and go, wow, I can't believe how far we've either come or how much further we need to go? Anything like that?
Well, it's funny. I got involved in this space in 2010 and really dove into the insurance and mapping right before the Biggert Waters Act was passed. Right. And then Biggert Waters, of course, changed the landscape of flood, since it was passed. And what's really interesting is the industry still refers back to Biggert Waters. That was the last, if you count the reform bill to Biggert Waters, but Biggert Waters in 2012 was the last full reauthorization of the National Flood Insurance Program, and we're going on almost 10 years ago that bill was passed.
Can you believe it?
Well, what I can't believe is how many times the NFIP has been kicked down the road congressionally. That is shocking because it was a 5-year bill. So we're going on 4 years since the bill, almost 4 years or a little past that, since the bill's expired. So next September, should we not get a full reauthorization of the National Flood Insurance Program, Biggert Waters will be a 10-year-old bill, and it is still the piece of legislation, as amended, it is still the piece of legislation that all flood insurance through the National Flood Insurance Program is based off of. So it's really kind of it's interesting to not only see how far we've come since then, but how far we still have to go with legislative changes and some other things that are going on.
You're just tuning in. We're speaking with Joe Flood himself, Joe Rossi, Executive Director of the Massachusetts Coastal Coalition, also offering wholesale insurance. Yeah. As we're wrapping up here, Joe, sure. If folks want to find out more and they want to get in the know, per se, how could they do that?
Sure. Well, we have our annual, the MCC has our annual meeting coming up Wednesday night at 7 o'clock right over here. I know, at Stillwagon Brewery. So if you're in the area and you want to come down and see what we're all about, come on down. But you can find out more at NoFlood, KNOW, NoFlood. .org. And of course, for those looking for wholesale insurance solutions, joefloodinsurance.com. So, it's been really fun. This has been a really exciting year, all the way from, diving in and starting the insurance wholesaler to getting engaged this year. It's been really exciting. It's been a fun year.
Well, congratulations.
Thank you on
all aspects from moving forward and always retaining this information and sharing it with the fine folks, whether it's here on this radio program or joining the folks in the morning on the South Shore's Morning News to share details on the latest trends as they happen. We thank you.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Kevin. And, one of the unfortunate things that has happened this year is in the storm several weeks ago, a tree fell onto my brand new Bronco. And so we're diving right into to Junior D'Amato soon, and the timing couldn't be more perfect for that too.
Amen. Well, we will. That's a great segue, Joe. As what we'll do now is we will step aside. That concludes our number one. Our number two is ahead. Stay tuned for the ride. You tune in to 95.9 WATD Monday Night Talk.
WATD FM Marshfield, WBMS Brockton. This is the South Shore's radio station, 95.9 FM WATD. Streaming online at 95.9WATD.com. And with your smart speaker, just by saying play WATD.
McGuigan's Pub is an upscale Irish pub with all the class of a Boston pub. The menu offers favorites like steak tips, fish and chips, meatloaf, as well as burgers, sandwiches, and pizza. The relaxed, comfortable atmosphere at McGuigan's makes it the perfect place to eat, drink, and socialize with family and friends. New hours are Tuesday through Thursday, 4 to close, Friday through Sunday, 11:30 to close. McGuigan's Pub is at 546 Washington Street in Whitman, with the full menu available at McGuigan'sPub.com.
I'm Peter Brown of Tiny & Sons Auto Glass in Pembroke. People ask me, is there anything they can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
Is there anything I can do to prevent getting a broken windshield?
See? There is. Those big gravel trucks, when they're being loaded, rocks get stuck in the framework of the bed. Truck hits a bump, rock hits your windshield. It pays to stay way back.
It pays to stay way back.
However, if your windshield is broken, just call 1-888-64-TINIES. And thank you.
Monday Night Talk on Twitter. Start at 959watd.com/Monday Night Talk. And don't forget to add hashtag Monday Night Talk to your tweets. We now return to Kevin Tachi and Monday Night Talk.
Okay, we're back. Just a couple of stray cats strutting around. Well, we want to be a couple of stray cats that are driving around.
That's right.
And you want to make sure that you're out and about. Hey, quick note, if you haven't had a chance to stop by McGuigan's Pub or the patio at McGuigan's, highly recommended to go to either establishment. You never could be disappointed going to either. And they're fine some sponsors as well. Late in this hour, just to let you know, we have Michelle LaRue. She'll be joining us. She is a Boston Marathon bombing survivor. She's also a spokesperson for Curaleaf for their iCannabis program, and we're going to talk with her at the bottom of the hour. But right now, we're here to help Joe solve his problem looking for a brand new vehicle. And who do I call to your rescue is none other than the great automotive expert himself, Mr. Junior D'Amato. Junior, how are you?
Hey, how you doing, buddy? Hello, Joe.
Hey, Junior.
So Joe has a dilemma. He had a tree fall on his vehicle, and now a brand new vehicle.
It was a brand new Bronco Sport,
and now he needs to find a replacement. And he's thinking of going used. Do you have any advice as far as used?
First of all, you know, it's a great time to be with you guys. A good time of the year. The problem right now is that used cars are at a premium, number one. And secondly, there are a few really good dealers out there that aren't going to, in plain English, view when it comes to buying a new car. A lot of the car dealerships in our area down here in Raynham, with the exception of Central, as far as I know, they're putting a price premium, a price market adjustment on new cars, $3,000 to $5,000. A friend of mine this past summer went down to the Cape to buy a Kia Telluride, and she said, "I got the best bargain in the whole world. I only paid $2,000 over sticker for the car," and that was a bargain. Everybody else was $5,000 over sticker.
Wow!
So that's just, to me, that does not make sense. Now, used cars, another area of concern, because again, used cars are at a premium. There is no more NADA Kelley Blue Book for getting an idea of pricing. You go into a car dealership today and you trade in your 5-year-old car, you may get very close to what you paid for that thing back in the day. Same thing with boats. It's crazy. It really is. There is a shortage in supply and demand.
Junior, would you suggest now, because what I've seen in the market in looking for a car is that the used cars are sometimes actually more than the new cars because of the wait times to get them out of the factory. Is it, and I actually had a dealer who I got an agreement with to give me MSRP on an order of a new vehicle versus going to get a used that was about equal in cost. So would you say now is a good time, if you can wait, to order new and almost get better deals on those?
Well, it's absolutely 110% correct. The other thing which people do not think about is that all dealers, no matter where you are, you're located, they all get a regular car. For regular cars, they all get inventory. That's not a problem. You know, the specialty cars, though, is like my wife's Red Eye. That took almost 8 months to order when we ordered it to get it delivered because of specialty and all that crap. But a regular Jeep or a regular, not the new Bronco, but a regular Ford F-150, regular stuff is pretty much available, number one. And the big thing is if you go out of state, let's say you went to, maybe down to Kentucky, believe it or not, how absurd it sounds it is, or down to the Carolinas, they're discounting vehicles down there like crazy. In fact, some of the car dealers are going out of state to buy brand new vehicles and bringing them up. Yeah, so there's another possibility for you. But as far as you have to figure out what you want to buy and how you want to buy it. I mean, that's the bottom line.
Yeah, I love the size of the Bronco Sport. I had the Sport, not the full size. It was the compact SUV. It was perfect. Yep. Sat up high. It was right what I needed. And I'm thinking about actually ordering a Ford Maverick, the small truck from Ford.
Yep. Well, there are some of those around. And there are some of those around in some of the local dealerships, believe it or not. And the majority of them are pretty much loaded. One of the guys that works with me, him and his wife, just ordered one of these things. And I could have taken a gosh darn hammer and hit her over the head. She bought everything but the luxury package. I don't want to spend $4,000 more on a truck. But you don't realize that $4,000 you spend on the truck, you take it out over a 4 or 5 year loan. When you go to get rid of it, you're going to get all that money back, and all the luxury that group parts that are in that package gives you, the heated seat, the steering wheel, and all that kind of stuff. And then there's a smorgasbord of extra stuff that goes with it. You're not just spending $4,000 for that luxury package for a steering wheel and a seat heater. You're getting a whole lot more. And yeah, they're out there, some of these vehicles.
Yeah.
You know, it's this chat. I was going to ask you real quick, Junie, if you don't mind me asking. We're talking about the Bronco, and wasn't it back in September you actually had a loaner that was an EcoBoost four-cylinder?
Yeah, I had a couple of them. I had the Bronco Sport, and the next bigger one than that had the big fat tire. It was called the Blackwood, Brookwoods. I don't know the names of these things anymore, but it was something B Woods, that I can tell you. Maybe it was Bad Woods, Bald Woods, I don't know.
Yep.
But I did not like that one as much as I liked the first one I got. The first one I got, Carla can get in it without a problem, and it was nice, easy to drive, it felt real good. The second one was a, how can we say, a tough truck? It was a toughy type truck. It wasn't your average SUV that you're going to want to drive every day with the family in it. You needed a stepladder to get in it, but that's what it was built for. There are people that want that. They want to go after the Wrangler. In fact, the Wrangler this year, for the first time ever that I know about, has an optional package for big fatties, 35-inch tires. And what they had to do to make that work was do a little bit of suspension work, but more importantly, they had to bring out the taillights. That's right, bring out the taillights about an inch and a half, because there are laws that the taillights have to be visible from a particular angle. And with the big fat 35-inch tire sitting on the back of a spare, it was covering up part of the taillights, not physically, but at angles. So they had to do that. But yeah, if you want to buy a Wrangler today, you can get that. You can get one with a 35-inch fatty on the back of it on all four wheels. That's five big fat tires.
If you're just tuning in, we are speaking with the automotive expert. He's on the program on a regular basis, and we're talking used vehicles, some of the vehicles that Junie has had a pretty... He's known for test driving vehicles, as they sent him a press car on a regular basis. I want to digress back. I want to digress back into the used vehicle realm. Seeing, it's interesting. I remember back, 20, 30 years ago, buying a car that had, 70, 80, 90,000 miles. It was one of those things, like, ooh, that's high miles. But when I look on, you know, the car websites to sell your car or buy a car, actually buy a car, people are selling their vehicles with 150, 160, 200,000 miles, and they're asking a king's ransom. Is that a thing?
You know what? You don't like it? Someone else will. Both of my loaner cars, Kevin, have in excess of 200,000 miles on them, okay? Wow. And cars today, as long as they're maintained, will run, you know, 250 without much of a problem, unless you have one of those CVT automatic transmissions. There's a class action suit. I had a lady today come in and we were talking about it. She says, I just had to pay $5,500. I was 3 months out of warranty. I called everybody and their brother. I said, you did not call the major TV networks. You did not decide you wanted to get on a small claims court over it. The CVT transmissions on all of the Nissan products, for the most part, they self-destruct. And the CVTs are made by one company that basically gives them to all the car companies. And Toyota's using CVTs. Nissan is using a CVT. We were going to buy Carla a new winter car, and it was a beautiful Maxima. And the only reason why I didn't buy it, it had a CVT in it.
Mm.
Back to a regular Toyota with a 6-speed automatic and no stories out of high school. But there are a lot of, like even Subaru now, a lot of CVTs, and they pretty much have limited the power, believe it or not, off the record in some of these engines. That way they don't burn out a CVT. And you certainly can't tow much with a CVT transmission, even though they rate it as that, because they just burn out. They self-destruct.
You know, as in the other thing too, Junior, is I love your perspective on this whole idea of naturally aspirated versus these turbos that we see Ford really pushing. You know, everything now is the 2-liter turbo or the, you know, 5-liter with the, you know, some type of turbo or you know, with some of the bigger cars with the superchargers to get the power out of it you're looking for. Do those become problems over time, or is that something that, like you said, as long as it's maintained, become
it's pretty
something
much straightened out, Jojo? And the big thing is people, I got to tell you, the majority of people, not minority, the majority of people, when it comes to servicing the vehicle, hey, how much is an oil change? What kind of oil do you want to put in it? You cannot shortchange yourself on oil. I've got to get oil for my you know, my wife's car tonight. The oil filter alone is going to cost me probably 12 and change. The oil itself is probably another $10 a quart.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I can go down to Wally World and buy synthetic oil for $3 a quart. But it doesn't have everything that these cars need, number one. And the turbochargers, they're absolutely fabulous. Superchargers are great. I just gave back a couple of days ago, they came and pick up and drop off, a 3-cylinder, count them, 1, 2, 3, 3-cylinder Trailblazer with a turbo.
Hmm.
And it was a pretty interesting vehicle. It was a brandy new one. I don't even know what the thing cost. They said, yeah, just take this for a few days. We're throwing it out there. See what you think. I was impressed as heck with it.
Hmm.
3-cylinder turbo.
And did it have get up and go? Did it have power?
It was a front-wheel driver for the most part.
Okay.
You know, until you started to slip the wheels where you push the button and put it in four-wheel drive or all-wheel drive, I guess you'd call it. It would blow the front tires.
Hmm.
Well. 3-cylinder Chevy turbo, and it was called Trailblazer.
Interesting.
I never thought that I would see that in that, but it was, and it was okay. But, you know, the power, I think, the power wars are on. With all the car companies right now, Chevrolet has their new Corvette, the C8, which is a mere 495 horsepower. That's faster than the predecessor that it had, that had more horsepower. And now for this year, they're up a bit. For 2023, they lowered the displacement, the size of the engine, and they're up to 675 normally aspirated horsepower. Joe's going to like this. At 8,600 RPM.
Mm. Wow.
It's got the same Mustang 350 flat style crankshaft design, which is really efficient, and it gives a whole new sound to the vehicle. It will sound more like a Ferrari and a Lamborghini than they ever did in their entire lives, and they're coming along. Chrysler for 2023 or 4 has got their new four electric motor, which can be a Challenger or the full size Dodge, and that's 1600 horsepower. 400 horsepower per wheel, 0 to 60 in a couple of seconds, 2 seconds.
Jeez, wow.
I mean, they're changing the way they go. And the other thing that Chrysler just came out with, well, we won't just give it all to Chrysler. Chevrolet just came out with their new crate engine. They're doing it at the SEMA show this month. And that's 1,001 or 2 horsepower, whatever it is.
Yeah, I saw that. That thing is unbelievable.
But 632 inches fuel injected. And now Chrysler is coming out with their kit this month for SEMA. You'll see the catalog probably within a week or two. And that's going to be a performance catalog. They're doing it again. And you can take your Hellcat or your Red Eye down to the dealer and have them change the blower pulley, which speeds up the blower. And you put a little, what they call a download or tuner, and there's another instant 100 horsepower. If that's not enough, you can do a camshaft and some valve springs, and now you get about 230 plus horsepower, all under factory warranty. So now you've got a car that the Red Eye is 797. Now you spend whatever it's going to be for the first grade upgrade, stage one. Now you're at 897. And then you go for the camshaft and this valve spring work they're going to do, and now you're 1,000-plus horsepower.
Well, and you know, that's shocking, because I remember the early days of the Challenger, and the problem was some of these superchargers would void the warranty because it would blow the drive shaft out of them when you would put them in. So
they weren't designed for that.
Yeah.
These cars are designed, and seeing you mention it, the drive shaft, the direct connection cataloging now for anybody that's a Dodge fan is going to have all the after market performance stuff with the Chrysler name on it or Dodge name or whatever you want to call it, drive shafts, rear ends, axles. You'll be able to build a drag pack car right from that parts book. You can have the shell delivered. You then get all the internals, the parts, the blah, blah, blah. And remember, DragPack Challenger is a car that does not have a vehicle identification number or call the VIN number. It cannot be registered, and it can't be driven on the street legally. Okay, and these cars are basically a race car only. You can also buy them right through the parts department of the Chrysler dealership. You get on a list, you do blah, 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 and now you have yourself a full-blown race car. Again, these cars come, Ford has it, and GM has it. These cars come, you buy the car, it comes with a bill of sale, no title, and they're not registrable.
What are we talking about for a kit like that?
You're looking at three figures.
Wow.
Wow.
Yeah. So things are really changing. The other thing you can talk about real quickly, for everybody now, we're thinking about winter tires. You've got to be really careful about what you buy and how you buy. You go into your local big tire store, whatever it might be, and that sales guy says, I got this one, and I'm going to sell them whatever. And, you know, everybody's got to make a dollar. But a lot of times these sales guys get an extra incentive to sell Kevin or Joe a tire that they don't really need for that particular vehicle. Over-aggressive tires are noisy. They wear out sooner. They scallop. And they don't ride like, you know, they don't like ride like a regular all-season or smoother tread pattern. If you do not have to go out when it snows, or you don't have to go out until they clean the roadways, then you want to get the least aggressive tire that you can, and you'll be very happy that you did. You don't need the big fatties that you see in a lot of these Jeeps and the Wranglers and stuff like that. That's what they're doing to a lot of these people going in there. I like the idea of a fat, big, you know, tire. Okay, good, we'll put them on. Then you put them on, and you hate the vehicle because it's shaking, it's riding terrible, and blah, blah, blah. And you own them, you wanted them, or the salesman would try to upgrade you to that. So you got to be real careful when it comes to tires. And there are a lot of Chinese and Japanese tires out there. And you know what? They're not half bad. They certainly do seem to work. And just because it says 50, 60, or 70,000 mile warranty, they're not saying that you're going to get that kind of mileage. They're saying in that warranty, if you read it, that that's what the tire is guaranteed for. If you go 50 grand, 60 grand, and you know, hit a pothole, maybe it goes defective or something like that, then it's prorated. But you're not guaranteed to get the mileage that it's guaranteed for.
Long gone are the days where you would, oh, it's that time of year, I'm going to change out my regular radial tires for my snow tires with the studs in them. No longer do we have those days, do we?
We don't have those days per se. That was April to May, number one. Number two, we still have tires that have studs available to do on them. You have a lot of winter tires now, studless tires. The big difference between the winter and summer tire, it's not necessarily the complete tread design. It's the amount of silica in the tire tread pattern, as well as what they put into the tire to make it soft. Tires tend to harden as the temperature gets colder. A snow tire doesn't do that. An ice tire doesn't do that at all. If you take one, let's say, Blizzak ice tire, put it on one wheel, and you put a regular all-season tire on the other side of the car, that Blizzak tire or whatever snow tire you put on will wear down 50% within the first 90 days of driving it on regular hot asphalt.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
It's not made for that. That's why you need to take those tires off, during the spring and put them back on in the fall.
We got a few minutes left with you, Junior. Any other tips you want to give us in regards to whether it's recently tested vehicles?
Sure. We talked a few of them. Yeah. When we get on to buy the something as minor, Kevin, as buying windshield washer fluid. Everybody uses the blue fluid. It's like $3 a gallon, whatever it might be. Step up a couple of more bucks and buy the Rain-X fluid or the purple fluid, and it not only will help clean your windshield, if you buy the Rain-X fluid, it actually puts a little bit of a Rain-X coating on the windshield as your wipers work back and forth. As far as windshield wipers, cheap wipers don't work. Cheap wipers chatter, and they tend to want to freeze up when it gets cold, just like the rubber on a tire. There's a big difference in windshield wiper blades. And as far as oil, I know that I'm ordering oil tonight. It's 040 for our cars. You never thought of that. Some of the Toyota vehicles, the new ones, we have 016. Mm. Not 15, 016 engine viscosity oil. And you better adhere and do that, because if you don't, if you put the wrong oil in, it can set a check engine light. It can cause all kinds of internal solenoid problems, because that's what we have in these cars now. We have internal electronic slash hydraulic solenoids that control valve timing and things of that nature. And you've got to use the right oil.
Joe, you got one last question.
Well, Junior, have you, I feel like you mentioned earlier it's a battle of the horsepower, but I also feel like it's a battle of the large SUVs right now as well. They keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. Have you had a chance, or what are your thoughts on the newest addition to that lineup, which is the Jeep Wagoneer?
They have the Jeep Wagoneer and the Grand Wagoneer.
Grand Wagoneer, yeah.
Yeah, we had all of those cars couple of months ago down at our stable when Chrysler I think it's called Stintus, whatever you call it.
Yeah, Stintus.
FCA is now, yeah, whatever it is. Yeah, we had all of those, and that big Grand Wagoneer is just as large as a big Chevy Suburban or a Cadillac ESB, the big one. And it's probably the best in its class. That Jeep Grand Wagoneer, then you have the Wagoneer, then you have the Grand Cherokee, then you have the Cherokee. We had every one of them vehicles there, and these vehicles all came in a truck for us to play with for that one day, and they were on display before they were even being sold. And I gotta tell you, that Grand Cherokee or the Grand Wagoneer, it's unbelievable. It is an electronic gadgetry vehicle with more electronics. I think it had 73 total inches of dash in center illumination.
Wow.
73 inches.
Oh,
Figure that out.
Wow.
That's huge. That's for us old people that can't see. And again, the engines are coming in are crazy. The power wars, the SUV wars, and they're delivering a lot better fuel economy. And again, these things have very big tires on them, and most of them have movable power running boards. And it's going to be an interesting fact to see what happens over the next couple of years. We have more electric cars coming out. We've got faster electric cars. And finally, my one complaint we had over the years with these, you'll be able to travel well over 400 miles on a plug-in. The Jeep Wrangler I had 2 weeks ago, I never started the engine, Joe.
Wow.
Never stopped. We drove it with just electricity.
Hmm.
That'd be something for my buddy Kevin to drive.
It would be. So my final question before we say goodbye to you is, what will be the first retro car that will be electric?
As to retro meaning?
I'm talking like the Mustangs. We've been seeing the big three coming out with the old school Mustangs, the Barracudas, or the Camaros.
Well, you're not going to see that stuff like you used to anymore, Kevin, because we have a problem with front bumpers and back bumpers. We have a problem with airbag placement.
Yep.
But you will see a lot of the aftermarket companies starting to do that. I know Factory Fire right down here in our backyard, they're toying around with some electric powered, Cobra kit cars. And the new Challenger coming out probably in 15, 18 months, that's going to have four electric motors in it and some really nice range. And you look at now what they're talking about now with Tesla. They have that car they call the Plaid, $130,000, and it runs in the 9-second bracket at 140 plus miles an hour.
Wow.
Yeah. And you're going to see more and more of this. The electric cars are here. There's no way getting around it. The internal combustion engine cars, they're not going away as fast as people would think, but they are going to start dwindling as time goes on. You have a new Ford pickup truck, the Lightning. The lights go out in your house. Just plug the car in, and it'll power your house up.
Yeah. It's phenomenal.
Crazy. Yeah.
Technology, you have to love it. Well, Junior,
technology is like you, Kevin, with all your electronics, all your video equipment now, and all you're doing on Facebook and the popularity that you have. I mean, look at all you're doing just from sitting in your house.
Isn't it wonderful?
You did it, man. You made it. I'm proud of you guys.
Well, listen, Junior, let's have you back on in a couple of weeks.
You know what? You know my number.
We'll update folks on the used car market and other things that are coming down the pike.
Happy holidays to both Joe, the listeners, Kevin, family, and everybody else involved.
There he is, Junior D'Amato, our automotive expert. Great having him on. And Joe, want to thank you for staying an additional segment to chat it up with Junior. We're going to step aside, and when we come back, Michelle LaRue, we'll chat with her in just a moment. You're tuned into Monday Night Talk here on 95.9 WATD.
This is Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi, on 95.9 WATD.
Each year, about one out of two men and one out of three women will develop cancer. But there's good news. Today's cancer survival odds are much better than 2 or even 3 years ago. Things move that fast. So if you're diagnosed, be sure to have someone in your corner who is on top of all the latest cancer treatments and techniques, the latest research, the newest equipment, all the newest medicines available through clinical trials. And speaking of corners, here's more good news. Advanced cancer care is now just around the corner. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare treats patients locally, with all oncology services and specialties conveniently housed under one roof. The center is affiliated with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center, so you'll be seen by Harvard Medical Faculty physicians and oncologists. The Green Cancer Center at Signature Healthcare, in affiliation with Beth Israel Deaconess Medical Center. Cancer has just met its match. Find out why at mysignaturecare.org/cancercare.
Are you worried about your drinking?
Or is someone else worried about your drinking?
Alcoholics Anonymous has a solution.
There is no shame in living with a disease called alcoholism.
Regardless of your age, employment, or any other circumstances in your life, you deserve help from other individuals who understand what you are going through. Alcoholics Anonymous is here for you 24/7 at aa.org. Find online meetings at aaboston.org.
a part of the show. Call in and join in on the conversation. 781-837-4900. Now, back to Monday Night Talk with your host, Kevin Tachi.
Welcome back for the final segment of Monday Night Talk. This final segment is one of enlightenment, one that one of great interest. Any of you who recall just about a month ago, we had our first Boston Marathon being run or taking place in the fall because of COVID. We've had to make those changes. But some of us also remember the Boston Marathon for an incident that took place back in 2013, the Boston Marathon bombing. And my guest who's joining us right now so happens to be not only a survivor from that incident that took place in 2013, but she's also someone who's had to not only deal with the wounds that came from that day, but also other things that have caused her to have to look within for ways to be able to quality of life, to try to restore it if possible. Michelle LaRue is joining us. Is not only is she here to talk in regards to being a survivor, but more so to talk about being a spokesperson for Curaleaf's iCannabis campaign. Michelle, welcome to Monday Night Talk, and thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I very much appreciate it. I'm glad to be here.
Not to necessarily relive that day when I think it changed the world and I think astounded all of us here in the Boston area to think that there would be a terrorist attack. But what is it? How did life change for you on that fatal day?
Life changed drastically for me on that day. I was severely physically injured. I had open blast wounds to my left leg. My left arm was torn open from my armpit to my elbow, and both my eardrums were blown out. So I spent weeks in the hospital, and I had, within the first week in the hospital, I had three surgeries, multiple procedures during each surgery. And I continued on to have additional surgeries and went through the healing process for well over a year. So it was not an easy time in my life. And, it wasn't just physical injuries. It was also emotional and mental injuries, if you will. So it was a lot. It was a very confusing time in my life. It was also a time in my life where I think I realized how grateful you need to be every day that you wake up, that you are physically well, because in a matter of a second, it can be taken away from you and it doesn't have to be from a terrorist attack. So that was something that I hadn't really ever thought a lot about. And now it's something that I think about a lot.
I would ask you this. So as time has gone on, and as the healing, I'm sure that the physical wounds have healed to a degree. Are there any further surgeries, or the surgeries? Are you done with any surgeries?
I do. I'm up for another surgery on my left ear. I've had two prior surgeries on it, and it's unfortunately just not taking well. So I don't have much hearing. I wear a hearing aid in my left ear. And my right arm, at some point, I will have to have more scar tissue removed because the injury was quite large. And I have skin grafts, and there's a lot of scar tissue that builds up that presses on the nerves. So I do suffer from quite a bit of nerve pain. So it's something, that I know will be in my future. My leg is, it does give me problems. I'm not really sure what more they could do. So I don't really know what will happen with that, but I run. So I can't complain. I can run. I can work out. I'm physically very strong. But I do, you know, there are times when it's bothering me a lot. But you know, you just, I think when you go through something like this, even if you're living with some pain, you have so much gratitude for not that it wasn't worse, that it's hard to feel sorry for myself. So I don't.
So I would ask you, is the physical part, you know, is one thing, but then feeling the pain, what has it been like to at least try to find comfort, depending on what you've been provided for certain medications?
So for me, the medications just didn't work well for me for many reasons. You know, as far as nerve pain goes, we tried a few things. Again, they didn't really work for me. So I've just sort of learned to deal with it. Again, this is where, so I guess I'll start kind of going into the sleep problem. So for me, with my PTSD and anxiety, I did suffer from some anxiety prior to the bombing. But after the bombing, it just was very hard to deal with. And it affected my sleep to a degree that I've never experienced. I've always been someone, my mom used to joke that it didn't matter where we were, I would always fall asleep within a minute of being put to bed. And I was like that my entire life. And after the bombing, I couldn't sleep. I had, you know, trauma dreams. I still have trauma dreams. It's not as often, but I still have them. It tends to happen more when I have a high level of stress going on. But my sleep just, it got to be so bad that I was living on 2 hours of sleep a night for quite a few years. And the medications they would give me were sometimes the warning labels made me not want to take them. And a lot of them, to be honest, made me feel horrible in the morning. I would wake up and I would constantly feel like I was trying to shake it off. And it would take me, you know, an hour to hours to feel like I was awake. And, you know, I'm the kind of person, I get up at 5 a.m. and work out, and I felt like I was sleepwalking. It was a horrible feeling. And that's when I was talking to a veteran friend, and he did multiple tours, you know, in the Middle East, and excuse me. And he had some of the same issues, and he started talking to me about cannabis that had higher CBD levels in it, which I didn't really know was a thing. I know about CBD, of course, but I didn't realize you could use cannabis, like an edible, if you will, like that had CBD and THC in it, and that you could play around with the ratios to figure out what worked for your body. And what I was able to discover was that if I used, you know, a cannabis product that had a high CBD content and still had THC, but at a lower level, it put me to sleep, and it puts me to sleep really well. And I stay asleep for more hours than I was getting before. And I don't feel horrible in the morning. I can get up, I can go running, I can be present in my life and not feel like I'm trying to shake something up and not feel medicated, if you will.
You are just tuning in. We are privileged to be speaking with Michelle LaRue. And Michelle is not only a Boston Marathon survivor, but she also is a spokesperson for Curaleaf and their iCannabis campaign. Now, what's the interesting question I'm going to ask you is knowing that there has long been a stigmatism around cannabis and marijuana, and it slowly seems as though that's lifting per se. Was there anything within your, you know, that you had to make a decision, or was it a matter of, you know what, if I'm getting good advice from somebody who's had success, I'm going to try this?
No, I immediately tried it. But I will say I immediately tried it, but I did not talk about trying it. I did not tell people because again, there was a stigma around it. And I was definitely myself even hesitant to talk about it because I thought, goodness, what will someone think? That are they going to think, you know, who knows what someone could think, because there are some are, I think they are going away. So I don't know whether I use is or are, like, but yes, I was kind of using it in secret, if you will, like, just, you know, close friends and family knew that I was trying this. But no, I did not hesitate, because I was at a point where I was really struggling and trying to be a mom and work a demanding job and live my life. It was really hard when you're not sleeping. And I felt like no sleep was actually making my anxiety and PTSD worse. And it just was, I couldn't continue living that way. So I started using it, and it immediately started working for me.
So I would ask you this, is could you recall that first night that you fully recharged your batteries, where you weren't just mm-hmm. sleeping for 2 hours? What was that like?
I got like about 5 hours of sleep straight. I fell asleep very quickly, and I slept for about 5 hours straight. And I remember waking up and thinking, what time is it? And then going back to sleep, because that also is another challenge. If I woke up, which I always did, I could not fall back asleep. And I remember thinking, like, when I woke up, you know, in the morning after the night had gone by, was I didn't feel awful. I didn't feel any after effects of having used it. And that was key for me. The other medications that I had tried, some of them did help me sleep, but it wasn't worth the feeling that I had when I'd wake up in the morning. And by using cannabis, that wasn't there. I can get up in the morning and go for a 5-mile run and feel normal. And that's amazing. And that was part of the reason why, when I was approached about this iCannabis campaign, I was nervous. I was nervous because, you know, a lot of people I do know don't know that I use cannabis. And I was a little intimidated at the thought of people knowing, but then I thought, you know what? It's more important that I share my story about this, because there could be other people suffering similar issues that don't realize this is an option, and that it's okay if you try this option. It should not be taboo. This should be something I feel that doctors bring up as an option. And unfortunately, that's not something that I see that happens. Maybe it does, but my hope is that someday that all doctors use this as an option for their patients, if it's something that would help them.
So what I would ask you was there a little experimenting at first? I mean, how did you go about the process? If somebody is listening and they are mm-hmm. suffering from PTSD and they're like, oh, yes. Oh my goodness. So what was it like to try to get it to a proper amount of milligrams that you took, that you saw success, repeated success?
So I had somebody to help me. So I did have a very close veteran friend that was there to help me. And he was kind of doing it for me, helping me through the process. So for me, I feel I do have my medical card. So I think that for someone that may want to try this, I think the important thing is that they realize that some of these dispensaries that have medical cannabis or a medical side, or like the one I go to is all medical, you can have a consultation. You can sit down with somebody and talk to them about what you need help with, or what, you know, what issues you're having. And they will do their best with their knowledge and their experience to help find a product that is good for your issue, your symptoms, whatever it may be. And I think sometimes that might be a little intimidating, because people don't know that it's, you know, I think going into a dispensary is intimidating, and the fact that some people don't know what to expect. They don't know what they're going to do when they go in there. They may be overwhelmed. I don't know what to get. And then there's different strands. So I think that is overwhelming for someone that doesn't know. So I think it's really important that you find a facility that you know, that you can sit down with someone and talk to them about what your options are. And, you know, I've been into a few dispensaries, and they're all very kind and very understanding. And you can have conversations. And that's important to know, because again, I don't think everyone knows that. And even the thought years ago of going into one, that seemed intimidating to me as well. And now I look back and I kind of go, geez, like, why didn't I do this sooner? So my advice to somebody would be to seek out a place where you can talk to someone and, you know, possibly even sit down with them, because it is very helpful.
So I would ask you, Michelle, is how long have you, how long has this campaign been ongoing for CuraLeaf, and how long have you been a spokesperson? Has it been a long endeavor, or is this something new?
I just started with them earlier this year. So it's relatively new, and it's great. They have so many great people involved, and, you know, everybody's story is different and unique in their own right. And they all, people all use it for different reasons. And I think it's a campaign worth checking out, because someone may be able to, you know, read about somebody's story or hear their story and realize that maybe they can relate to it. So I think that this campaign is incredibly important, and I'm glad to be a part of it, because I really like how they rolled it out and the compassion and the understanding that is around this campaign. It's something that I do believe will help break some of the stigma of cannabis.
Again, we are speaking with Michelle LaRue. She is not only a Boston Marathon survivor, but she is also a spokesperson for CuraLeaf's iCannabis campaign. And that's what we're talking to. We're kind of trying to build the story here so you understand what Michelle has endured, you know, during an event that nobody would know. None of us have a crystal ball. We would be able to avoid that. But how the trials and tribulations, and how she's gotten here, and how she's trying to help others who might be suffering similar situations in regards to trying to get some sleep, alleviate themselves from pain. I was fortunate enough to pull up a Boston Herald op-ed piece that you did on October 8th, just prior to the stepping off of the Boston Marathon in October. What was it like to put that together?
It can be a little intimidating when you're putting something together to be, you know, published, but it's, you know, I just have to be honest and speak from my heart about what I've experienced and share that and hope that, you know, that it reaches somebody and may help someone else. You know, I have spent years working with survivors of terrorism around the world, and, you know, I've also come to realize that there's many people that suffer from issues that are not related to terrorism that this could also help. So my hope is that, you know, maybe there are people that read these op-eds and can find something useful out of it for themselves.
It's interesting, and I'm going to read a paragraph from your op-ed. Since the Boston Marathon bombings, I've been on a mission to share my experiences with others around the world, especially those who have faced the worst of human nature, to show them there is still light, there is still hope. Mm-hmm. Touching words.
Thank you. Thank you.
What I would ask you is what was it? Did you have a chance to either watch or be at the Boston Marathon, or did you participate in some way?
So this year I had a veteran friend run. So survivors, every year since the bombing, we've been given guest bibs by the Boston Athletic Association. So that's been absolutely incredible that they have done that for us. And this year I had a veteran friend of 20 plus years run on my bib. So that, I did go, I can't go down to Boylston Street. I've only been there one time since the bombing on Marathon Day. It's just too much for me. So we did stand out on the marathon course out in Newton and watched him around mile 18. So it actually was a really nice experience, to be honest with you. It was one of the first years, this year was one of the first years I stood out there and didn't think about the bombing. And I don't know if that's partly because actually, it probably was, partly because it was also in the fall, a different time of year. You know, it was a happy experience this year. And I left with a smile on my face. I had my son with me and we cheered him on, and it felt amazing. And every year I've tried to give my bib to either a U.S. veteran or to use it to raise money for a terrorism survivor group. So, that also makes my heart happy to be able to do that as well.
Is there anything that I haven't asked you during our conversation here, but there's a tidbit of information that you feel is going to be helpful to anybody who's listening who might benefit from this conversation?
I mean, one thing I always say to people, and I feel like this is really important, is whatever you're going through in your life, whatever you've experienced, there's always somebody else out there that has experienced it as well. And I think that a peer-to-peer connection is probably one of the most important things in the healing process for anybody. And whether it's fighting cancer or being a victim of terrorism or whatever it may be, recovering from a car accident, it's really important to find somebody else that you can speak to that has gone through the same thing, because your family's amazing to have, doctors are amazing to have, but a peer-to-peer connection is something that I feel is very instrumental in the healing process. And in regards to cannabis, don't be afraid to explore that. Even if you feel like it's taboo, you should still explore that as an option, because you never know. If you are suffering, you should always explore any options that are available to you. And I really, truly hope that over time, this becomes a mainstream thing. I do believe it is becoming that, and I believe that it can help a lot of people.
Have you gleaned any success from the campaign yet? Have you had anybody approach you who've read your words, or they've heard you and said thank you, that at least you've at least helped someone today?
Yes. Yes. And I will tell you, I have been both shocked and amazed by some of the people that I know that have come to me and said, hey, I use cannabis too. And I'm like, what? Like, it's amazing how we look at people and the way they look, or maybe what job they have or how they are in their life, and we just assume they would never use cannabis. And I'm sure someone that looks at me probably thinks the same thing. And we shouldn't think that. And it was very surprising to me in a good way. Some of the people that said to me, hey, I use this too. You know, I can't even tell you, it was crazy. And I've had a few people come to me as well, people that I know that have said, what do you use? Because this is what I'm suffering with. And I've had many friends, I would say at least a half a dozen, say, I have sleep issues because of X, Y, and Z. Do you think this could help me? So yeah, it's been kind of like, wow, I surprised and amazed. And it made me feel also, because of course I was a little nervous the first time I shared, because, you know, it was, you know, the first time out of the gate and here I am. And the response I got was overwhelmingly positive. There was no negative reactions to it at all. And that made me very happy. And it also made me realize that a lot more people than we think are okay with this.
Now, the one thing I haven't asked you, now, that you take in cannabis, is it edible? And are you somebody who has like a particular flavor? And what it was, you know, is there a flavor that you have liked if you do edibles?
I do edibles, and I also use tincture. So, which is like a liquid, if you will. So, no, I make my own edibles. So that's, you know, I buy the flower and then I make it into oil, and I bake with it. So that's, I can't smoke cannabis. I am a runner. So that's not an option for me, but, I know many people that use it all different ways. So to be honest with you too, I'm still exploring sometimes. There are many different things out there that, you know, I wasn't even aware of. I recently went into Curaleaf and they gave me this different type of edible. It was a gummy, and it was something that kicked in a little quicker, if you will. And I couldn't stay awake. And I was like, wow, this is good. So I'm still experimenting myself. And, you know, it's definitely, you have to find what works with you. You definitely have to try different things to see what works best for you. You may think one thing works great, but then you may try something else and it may work even better. So yeah. And it feels like they're coming out with new things all the time. So
you definitely have to love technology. Well, we're basically out of time, but I cannot thank you enough for coming on this radio program, sharing your story, and hopefully it's going to help many more people, whether it's with this radio interview and some of the pieces that you're writing and some of the, you know, the campaign that they're probably still, that Curaleaf is still rolling out. I want to thank you. And if folks have any questions in regards to Curaleaf, do you have any information to share in that regards?
I would say go to their website. You can see a list of their facilities and, you know, you can choose one that's closest to your area. They have medical dispensaries and they have other dispensaries that are for recreational and medical. So definitely go to their website. It's very useful. And yeah, they're a great company. I'm glad to be working with them. And thank you for having me. I really appreciate it.
We've been speaking with Michelle LaRue, and she is not only a Boston Marathon survivor, but also a spokesperson with Curaleaf, part of their iCannabis campaign. And that's all the time that we've been allotted this week. But fear not, we'll be back next week at 6:15 p.m., and we'll do it all over again. Until then, have yourself a great night.